Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Rick Arner, who'll be telling us about his experiences at Pier 9 and the Lost and Found in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hey, Art, thanks. Welcome to my home.
I see your bodyguard's keeping an eye out for you over your shoulder there.
Yeah, I just hope he doesn't get vocal. That's Troy.
So I understand that you have a pretty long history with the gay bars in Washington, D.C., dating back to about 1970. And one of the bars we've discussed before, I've discussed with in other interviews, was known as the Pier, but when you started there, it was known as Pier 9, and it was located on Half Street in Washington, D.C. Tell me about Pier 9 and what your impression of it was when you first walked in the door there.
Interesting that you bring that up, Art. I was set up by my friend Mickey to have an interview with the owner, Carlos, at the time, and I went up to his office. And I mean, my first recollection of walking in the bar was huge. I had never been in a club or a bar at that time. Coming from New York, I was used to really small places. Walking into the Pier, it was like, oh my God, this is like Hollywood. I went upstairs to the office for my interview, and I was handed a pair of white jeans by Carlos. And asked to please try the jeans on. They were a size 27, 26. I don't know. Back then, I could fit into it, luckily. fit into the jeans, and Carlos said, you're hired. He said, go downstairs and make yourself at home. Become familiar with the restaurant and the, the kitchen. Because you're going to start at the Pier as a busboy. And I want you to be familiar with everything. I went downstairs, and at the time, there was the chef setting up the kitchen. His name is Joe, and quite a character. I loved him. God, I loved him to death. May he rest in peace. And I started then as a busboy in the dining room. The dining room was kind of small. It could be expanded. It overlooked the dance floor. And it could be expanded onto the dance floor, depending on the crowd, which we did quite a bit on weekends, obviously. the menu was extensive. I was amazed. I said, this can't be a bar menu. And it was. I mean, everything, cordon bleus, filet mignons, you name it, Joe cooked it and cooked it well. And that really was my first experience with the Pier 9.
So the menu there was a little bit more upscale than what I would have expected. I don't know why, but in my head, I envisioned something more like typical bar food, like, you know, burgers and fried chicken or whatever. That kind of stuff.
But that's what I expected. And it was nothing like that.
Did you get a big dinner crowd there? Was it popular as a restaurant, or was it mostly focused on the bar aspect of it?
On the weekends, it was the restaurant. It started early in the evening on Fridays, excuse me, and expanded into the till around 9:30, 10 o'clock when the actual bar crowd showed up for dancing.
Now, I know from previous conversations I've had about the Pier that some years later, I think 6 or 7 years after you started there, the pier had a big makeover and had all kinds of fancy lighting and audio and everything installed and became a veritable disco. I mean, it was the dance bar, the music club in the area. What was it like when you were there in the early 70s? Was it still pretty impressive as far as the audio was concerned and the environment, or was it a little bit less polished?
It was polished. It was impressive to me. a young kid who was in, 19, 20 years old. And it was my typical disco bar. I mean, it had the disco balls. It had fantastic music. It had sound, a state-of-the-art sound system. So even back then, the sound system was quite elaborate, and the light show.
What was the clientele like? Who did it attract mostly?
At that point, it was mostly a younger crowd, except the dinner crowd was middle age, Capitol Hill office crowd, as well as your typical gay club crowd. I would say in their 30s, some in their 40s, but the dance club part of it catered to a younger crowd.
Nowadays, some of us wouldn't exactly consider 30 years old middle age. But
73 here, so it's like, no, I hear you.
It's funny how your perspective changes over time. When you're Absolutely. 20 years old, somebody who's 30 is ancient.
And whoever thought.
Yeah. Right?
Whoever thought.
So the original logo for Pier 9 was kind of a cool graphic. Looked like a life preserver with a gigantic arrow coming out of it, very phallic. Mm-hmm. What was the reason for the name Pier 9? Why was it called Pier 9? Do you know?
I really don't know. I mean, my only experience with the pier or the pier situation was from back in New York, down on the docks, back in the day.
Was it actually on the water? Was there actually any kind of dock or pier outside the bar? Or?
Well, we were, I'm trying to think now. Were we on the Potomac? I think we were close to it. Terrible neighborhood, absolutely terrible neighborhood. So I never ventured off to see what was around me, other than warehouses. It was a warehouse district.
Right. Which was common at that time. Back in the 70s, a lot of the gay bars were in industrial or commercial districts. They were off the beaten path. They were not on main streets with public facing windows. They were kind of discreet. Now, this building was not particularly discreet. You would see it driving down Half Street. It was right there. But
exactly.
And I understand it was a pretty popular place. It lasted, how long, do you know how long it lasted? It was there for quite a while.
It was there for what seemed forever. It was there when I left the Lost and Found in some way, shape, or form. I don't recall. It was probably Ziegfeld's at the time. I'm not sure, though.
So after,
but it was there for quite a while. I mean, it changed clientele. It went through a lot of iterations of clientele. I don't actually recall how long it had been. I know when I left the pier, when I left Lost and Found, I'm pretty sure the pier was still there. Yeah, because we kept going back and forth. The staff, when we got off, we would go down to the pier to dance. And then come back to the Lost and Found to dance. So yeah, it was still there 15 years in.
Now you just mentioned the Lost and Found, and that opened after you started at the pier. It wasn't open when you started at the pier, I don't think.
No, it wasn't. It opened about 2 years in.
What inspired What inspired you to move from the pier to Lost and Found? What was the attraction?
The person who was the maitre d' at the time at the pier, I think his name was Gus, suggested I go down to the Lost and Found and interview for their dining room. Back then, let me tell you, Art, we made very good money. So to change places of employment took a lot of convincing on their part. And when I say back then we made a lot of money, it was close to $300 a week. And that was mostly weekend tips. And for a young kid, that was a lot.
Yeah, especially in 1972 or whatever.
Absolutely. So Gus suggested I go down, and I went down and I interviewed with, who was it at the time? Actually, Gus went down also as maitre d' and he hired me to work at the Lost and Found. He brought most of the staff over from the pier. Joe Garrison, who was the chef at the time, I don't know if I can mention last names, may he rest in peace, but he brought a lot of us over with him. And then it changed ownership. The pier changed ownership. And interesting, because the gentleman who owned the Lost and Found bought out the pier, Don Culver, Bill Bickford at the time, bought an intro, actually bought, I believe they bought out the pier. So they ran both clubs. Different clients.
I've heard that before. And just to put it in perspective for people who don't do the math or weren't around in 1970, if you were to adjust $300 a week for inflation to 2022 dollars, it would be the equivalent of about $2,000.
Exactly.
So for people who are sitting there going, $300 a week, I can make that at McDonald's. No, this is the equivalent of making $100,000 a year today, primarily coming from income on the weekends from working at a restaurant in a gay bar.
Absolutely.
It's pretty impressive. Now, you had mentioned that Pier 9 had a nice upscale restaurant environment in it, and Lost and Found did as well. Lost and Found had a proper restaurant with quality food that I've heard a lot of rave reviews about.
Yes, it was. I mean, the chefs were former chefs that were brought in from the Culinary Institute. It was they had very impressive backgrounds.
And that was a little bit of an anomaly back then, because in the early 70s, any gay place that served food was typically considered some sort of a little dive or hole in the wall, because gay men would go anywhere and eat anything to be in a gay environment. They weren't being choosy because there weren't a lot of options. It's not like today where you can go anywhere you want. Back then, gay friendly environments a lot of times tended to be a little bit on the skeezy side, a little bit on the dive side. So this was a little bit unusual to have two kind of upscale restaurant bars in the same general vicinity in Washington, D.C. at the same time in the early 70s.
Drawing quite a large clientele, yeah.
Now, how would you compare Lost and Found to Pier 9, the bar itself?
Well, I'd say the Lost and Found was a lot more elegant in many respects. It was much larger. We expanded the dining room. The dining room had a beautiful fireplace in it. We expanded the dining room, and then we separated the dining room from the dance floor with this spectacular water wall. Don, I tell you, he spared nothing. He spared no money for it. I mean, he spared a lot of money, let's put it this way, that he put into the restaurant. And it was made to be elegant.
And the Lost and Found also attracted a huge crowd for the dance floor on the weekends in particular. I've been there a few times. Back, I think, in the 80s, when I visited D.C., and I will never forget that place. It was just mind-boggling to walk in there and feel like you had a palace. It was like you're walking into a bar that you felt good about being in. And as a gay person in the 70s and early 80s, that was not always the case. A lot of times you felt like, well, you know, this place is kind of dumpy, but this is where I'm going to meet my friends and see other gay people. But that place was like going to, you know, a Broadway theater or something. You felt like, oh, this is glamorous. And they built this palace for us. It was really kind of a special place.
It was very special. And funny that you mentioned the theater, because we had a theater attached. It was the Way Off Broadway Theater. that was attached by a deck, and it was quite something, attracting some really great acts.
Now, the crowd at the Lost and Found was also younger in the evenings, correct?
It was mixed. It's interesting because the restaurant would attract a lot of the Capitol Hill crowd. We had some senators and representatives that we would allow in through the back door because they wanted to maintain, you know, an air of, they didn't want to be known as going into a gay bar. Let's put it that way. So we would accommodate that, but it was a mixed crowd. I mean, the dining room crowd moved over to the dance floor after they were finished eating. And in many respects, we converted the dining room tables into bar tables. In other words, people would sit after dining and have their cocktails while they were dancing.
Very cool.
So it was cool. It was really cool. And we wanted to accommodate, we wanted to cater to as many different types as we could. Like I say, you had a lot of middle-age Capitol Hill types in the dining room, and you had your dancers in the main part of the bar that mixed in with the Capitol Hill types. And then we opened what was called the Attic, and it was sort of catering to the Eagle type bar bar person. Matter of fact, Mei Ling was the bartender up there, and he was a character, quite a character. But that was a separate entity for the Eagle type. We wanted to capture that business as well.
Now, in the 70s, both the Pier 9 and Lost and Found were predominantly male bars, correct?
Correct, at first.
And that was pretty normal in the gay scene back in that time frame, that there was not a lot of mixture between the lesbian and gay crowd or the gay and straight crowd. A lot of the bars were dedicated, not necessarily by force, but they just seemed to gravitate toward being more male-oriented or more female-oriented. And that was the case with both of those bars, correct? They were predominantly male in the 70s.
That's correct.
Now, you stayed at Lost and Found for 15 years. So you were there into the late 80s.
Yeah.
Is there any one story, memory, surprise, guest, something that happened at Lost and Found that just sticks in your mind that you think, wow, that was a great night because?
Every night was a great night, Art. Actually, we had, on one particular weekend, we had the Ice Capades were in town. And right after their last show, they would all come down to the Lost and Found to party and dance. I met, at the time, my boyfriend, who was a skater from Ice Capades. And that was memorable to me. also, because I would spend, you know, a lot of weekends when I may have been off, I purchased tickets to join him when the show went to the West Coast, to the Midwest, wherever it went. I was like a Trekkie. And then I would come back home to the Lost and Found.
I can understand that. I've met and dated a couple of ice skaters in my decades of gay experience. And historically speaking, as a generality, they have incredible legs and butts. That's all I'm going to say.
You got it. That's right. Yeah, that's right. But I have to tell you, Art, the Lost and Found and even the Pier, but for me, mainly the Lost and Found was very family. The people I worked with were family to me. I miss them terribly. And I'm glad that you're doing what you're doing, you know, getting people together to reminisce and putting memorabilia together, whatever you can. Because I was thinking, I wanted very much to do that. I wanted to see how many people I could track down via Facebook, because we were family. Don treated us like gold. Bill as well, Bill Bickford as well. We were like their kids. And I missed that. You don't find it that often in employers and employees. Luckily, I found a few people recently via Facebook, and it's been great reminiscing with them.
Yeah, I remember my first gay bar experience was in 77, and not too far from where you are. It was in Baltimore at the Hippo. I know back then a lot of the bars in the 70s and into the 80s, they were much more community oriented because we were still kind of outcasts in general society. You could not take your boyfriend to the mall and hold his hand or even look like you were being affectionate or, you know, too gay. You couldn't go to a restaurant with a group of four or five guys that look like they might be gay, because everybody else in the restaurant would stare at you and snicker and talk behind your back. And it was a different time. And the bars were the places we went to feel like we belonged to a community that accepted us and that shared our way of thinking, and that we could pursue the different concepts that we had in our heads. So many of the bars were an integral part of forming our gay community the way it is today, helping us get together and form, you know, softball leagues or nonprofit organizations. So many of our civil rights organizations started out, you know, being supported by the bars and being funded by activities at the bars over the years, that, you know, we might never have gotten to where we are today had the bars not been there for us.
That's true. That's true. And it was truly family, and truly missed.
I know that myself, as I've started talking to people, I've been doing this project for about 2 years now. And as I started talking about one bar, it kind of starts conversations about other bars, because people say, oh yeah, I went to Lost and Found, and then we used to go to this other bar and, you know, watch the strippers there. And then we'd go to this other bar, and it kind of connects the dots, and people start remembering things that they've forgotten about for decades. I'm really, really proud that the Facebook group that I started, which is only a little over a year old, has passed 4,500 members. And those people, as you can see, when you go in that group, comment on all kinds of things. You know, I welcome everybody to go in there and post a picture of themselves from 1978 working as a bartender, or to post a memory about something that happened in 1983 in a bar that they used to go to, and just watch the other people start, contacting them, communicating with them, and connecting in different ways. It's so rewarding.
It is. A couple of my friends posted pictures on my Facebook wall from the Lost and Found's 10th anniversary. And that was quite the affair. But it stirred a lot of memories on their part, because you see me today and it's nothing like what I looked like back then. But yet a lot of people remembered us from our 10th anniversary celebration, because it was such a blowout. It was quite, like I said, quite an affair. Don and Bill went all out, food, champagne, all on the house, just to thank the gay community for what they gave to us. So, I enjoy seeing the pictures and reminiscing with folks about that time.
Now, while you were working at Lost and Found, that was your job. There was no other daytime employment. You were a full-time employee, 15 years in the making at Lost and Found, starting as what, a waiter,
mm-hmm.
and working your way all the way up to operations manager.
Correct.
So that must have been quite an experience back then, to be that immersed in gay culture.
Unheard of. Leading, sadly, a double life from my family at the time, because I couldn't tell them. You know, and many of us did lead double lives because our families just didn't understand. That's why I gravitated towards them, because they were so family oriented. Working my way up to the management position was an accomplishment for me, because I was still a young kid. And Don and Bill found ways of thanking us in management for what it is we had given to them.
Now, Lost and Found, again, much like Pier 9, was located in an area that probably nobody in their right mind would travel to at night unless they had a very special reason. And Lost and Found, for hundreds, if not thousands of people, was that very special reason every weekend.
Absolutely. The lines would wrap around the building. You say you couldn't, you really didn't want to set foot outside the club. We had good security. We had great security that monitored the perimeter. And the police knew as well that they needed to be present in the area to help. But like I say, the lines would wrap around the block waiting to get in to the club. And interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing how sometimes gay bars can add life to an area. And I know that area over the decades has had numerous gay bars that have evolved in that same space and in adjacent spaces. Of course, now that's all gone now. That whole area is part of the National Stadium development area, isn't it?
So I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, so it's no longer a part of our gay history the way it sits now, but there are so many elements. You mentioned Trax. Trax was another one that was an amazing club for its...
Right across the street.
It's just, you know, to have a gigantic disco. Trax had the advantage, and it probably hurt Lost and Found's business a little bit, because Trax had the advantage of being known nationally through its other locations. I think there might have been one in Miami at one point. I know there was one here in Tampa. And the original one was in Denver, which is still operating.
Hmm.
So Trax had become quite a name in the gay nightlife industry then.
It took a lot to compete. It took a lot of creativity to compete with the likes of Trax or any other club really that was in the area. You also had the 8th Street corridor that had clubs that catered to the lesbian crowd, cater to the dance on the bar, go-go boy crowd. So, I mean...
I've been there too.
Yeah, you had a choice. You had a choice.
And I remember...
You had to be creative.
I remember, and I can't think of the name of it because it wasn't a big flashy bar, but I remember going into a go-go bar where the dancers danced on top of the bar top. And... Right. I seem to remember at some point during the evening, them also inviting some amateur go-go dancers from the audience and having a couple of patrons get up there kind of unexpectedly in their drunken stupor and try to be sexy on the bar.
Exactly.
I don't remember the name of the bar, but I remember being there and thinking how interesting that was. And especially when you contrast it to the conservative nature of Washington, D.C. itself. I mean, mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., I know, has some quirky parts and whatever, but when you generally think of Washington, D.C., you think of a bunch of stuffed shirts in expensive suits walking around acting like they're all important, and to find that kind of a fun club scene at Pier 9, at Lost and Found, at Trax, all in D.C., and then the, you know, the stripper bars and the other bars that were there. Badlands was another one I remember.
Right.
It's kind of a crazy situation that you don't expect to find in the seat of our national government.
That's true. That's true.
So what was the reason for you deciding to leave Lost and Found in the late 80s after 15 years? Almost 20 years, really, of gay bar experience.
Well, I mean, it was a combination of things. In management, towards the end of my career with them, we were pretty much on call 24/7. We'd come down to the club during the day. We would oversee the ordering of liquor, whatnot, and planning of the menus. And we had a beeper. We all wore beepers, and we were like attached at the hip. And it just became too much for me. I experienced a sense of burnout. I to this day remember going in to the office and telling Bill at the time in tears, please don't hold me to this, but I can't give you notice. I have to leave. I just have to leave. And he said, I understand. I understand. If there's anything you need, you let us know. And that was it.
And that was Bill Bickford you told that to?
Correct.
And he's still around, isn't he?
Yeah, Bill's out in the Midwest living happily with his family. I recommended that he might want to do an interview with you. He told me he came across a bunch of pictures from when we built the deck in between the theater and the bar. It was a beautiful deck, wooden deck. And he came across a bunch of pictures from the 10th anniversary party, as well as the deck. And I said, well, Bill, send them to me or send them to Art. And he laughed and he said, this old fart? He said, I don't know how. I'm not that savvy. I don't know how to send pictures. I don't know how to do it. So I kind of tried to tell him, you know, how to do it. And hopefully, you know, if you can do it, maybe hopefully you'll be able to figure out Zoom. I don't know. but he was a doll. And Don was like, oh, my God, Don, I wish you were alive today. I mean, may he rest in peace. Don was like, a brother. And there wasn't anything he wouldn't do for you. And likewise, you wouldn't do for him. So leaving was like leaving my brother and leaving a part of my heart behind. And that hurt.
So when you left Lost and Found, did you stay in D.C. for a while or did you move somewhere else?
Nope. I packed up a U-Haul. I sold my house and I drove my U-Haul across country. My brother at the time was living in Boulder, Colorado. And so my lover at the time and I went cross country and set up shop in Boulder for a while. I went into the mountains. I yelled. I screamed. I lost a little bit of weight, which I needed to do. I wish I could do that now. but I needed to vent. I needed to just, you know, get some fresh air, clear my head. And so I did that and ultimately was led to an interview with American Airlines. So I went to work for them for close to 30 years.
Well, that gave you an opportunity to travel at low expense.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, after you left Lost and Found, did you just avoid the gay bar scene completely or did you still occasionally go to a gay bar somewhere?
Totally avoided it. So because, you know, basically you on your days off, you spent when I was working at the Lost and Found at the pier, you spent your days off at the bar.
Right.
And, you know, that's the last place I wanted to go to, really, you know, on my free time. So I, at the time, totally cut myself off from the gay scene. And then, like I said, that's why I needed to get out of Washington and went cross country to Colorado, where it was easy to get away from the gay scene.
Is there anything you miss about it? About the gay bar scene?
Everything. Now, looking back on it, I miss the people. I miss the people and the friendships that were made. That's why I started looking for these folks again, hoping that I would find them. And you know, that's what I would miss.
Well, hopefully when we post the final version of this interview, some other people will see it and reach out, comment on it and say, oh, I remember him, you know, and maybe you'll connect with a few more because that's what the whole project is about. It's about you know, bringing back the memories and preserving the stories about all these places that 10, 20, 30 years from now, there'll just be a footnote somewhere. Nobody will know, you know, what Lost and Found was or who the people were that were involved with it. And to me, that's kind of a sad state of affairs, because there are hundreds and hundreds of books that you can find about, you know, gay politics.
Mm-hmm.
But the bars that were the core of our community, a lot of people have just ignored them, and they've just become somebody's memory. And when that somebody is no longer around to tell that story, that memory is going to be gone forever. So that's kind of why I want to do this and get as many of the different stories as I can into the internet.
Well, bless you for that. It's sorely needed.
Well, I'm happy to do it. And I've just recently discovered that one of our very supportive gay liquor brands, Stoli, who has done a lot of big events in the last decade or so, supporting and embracing the gay community, is actually launching a campaign that involves preserving gay history. So I'm really glad that somebody like that, some corporate, you know, large company with some influence, is getting behind this. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more information coming out about, you know, gay bar history. Obviously, being an alcoholic beverage company, that's an important part of their, you know, their contribution to history is what the bars have done. And so I'm really excited to be talking to them about it as well. And hopefully that will bring this even to a larger platform and a bigger audience.
Hopefully that's what's needed.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to tell us some of the stories from Pier 9 and Lost and Found and your history with the gay bar industry in Washington, D.C., because that's something that, you know, everybody needs to have access to, be able to learn about. And I appreciate you being able to give us those memories.
Thank you very much, Art. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode or to find more episodes, visit GayBarArchives.com.